I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. Every January 27th, the flag over the Bundestag, the German parliament, flies at half-mast. Members of the Bundestag arrive dressed in black and listen to hours of solemn speeches by Holocaust survivors and top elected officials. January 27th is the day of remembrance for the victims of National Socialism. It's a yearly reminder of the crimes committed in the name of the German people. From the nearly five-acre memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe in the heart of Berlin, to the over 300 memorial sites and documentation centers across the country, Holocaust memorialization is at the core of Germany's national memory culture. How then is it possible that Germany is unlearning the lessons of the Holocaust? This is the contention of historian Jürgen Zimmerer. Jürgen made his name through his pioneering research on Germany's first genocide of the 20th century in Imperial Southwest Africa. He's long argued that we need to recognize the imperial roots of the Holocaust in the Second World War in Eastern Europe. In his recent edited volume, Germany's History of Wars, Contesting Memory and Identity Today, he highlights how the singular view of the Holocaust, limited to anti-Semitism and the Nazi past, is allowing the Berlin Republic to resurrect and celebrate the imperial era. He warns that Staatsraison, or making the defense of Israel a state principle because of Germany's past, risks stifling free expression and providing a cover for Islamophobia. The universal lessons of the Holocaust should be about the protection of fundamental rights and respect for the nation's diverse communities. Instead, the memory of the Holocaust is being harnessed for exclusionary purposes in a narrow ethno-nationalist vision of the nation. A conversation with historian Jürgen Zimmerer about his book, Germany's History Wars, Contesting Memory and Identity Today, in this episode of the Realms of Memory podcast. Jürgen, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm so happy to have you. You can't do a podcast on how countries confront difficult histories without talking about Germany. And I began the podcast with a conversation with Susan Neiman about her book, Learning from the Germans. I've had a chance to talk to Jenny Wustenberg. And my sense is I kind of began on a high note, especially with Susan Neiman's book, began thinking, well, this is not by any means a perfect example of how to confront the past, but there's a lot to give credit to Germany for. And since then, I've just been adding caveats. And the more I've read, the more there seems to be a yes, but. I looked at Jenny Wustenberg's book, and it was yes, but what about East Germans? And now that I'm reading your work, it's yes, well, what about minorities in Germany? What about the imperial past? So there are a lot of caveats when you talk about confronting the past in Germany. And in the English version of your book, Germany's History Wars, you devote a whole new preface to explaining the issue of what's in German is called Staatsraison, reason of state. You try to lay out how this really gets at a lot of the politics, contemporary politics wrapped up in memory issues. A lot of politics that are very similar to things that are happening in the U.S. So I thought that I would begin by just asking you to, just if you could briefly explain, well, what is this? What does this term mean? Where does it come from? If you look on YouTube, you'll see endless feature stories on this particular term, debates, commentaries, especially over the past 3 years. Where does this term come from? What does it mean? Why is it so politically charged?
Well, this is a complex issue, because the term Staatsraison, the reason of state, is basically a concept from the Renaissance. It's Machiavelli. It means that the states have a logic of their own, and their interest, the state's interest, trumps the interests of the subjects and of the citizens. So it's a very undemocratic concept. And most people would agree that we thought that with the 19th, 20th century, particularly with the 20th century, this term was obsolete because we thought, yeah, we are democracies, we have rights, human rights, universal rights, and citizens' rights, and they are what really matters, and the state must not violate them. Now, the Staatsräson in the concept, in the context you mentioned, was used by the former German Chancellor, long-time Chancellor Angela Merkel, in a speech 2008 in Israel. She was speaking at the Knesset, and she said that the security of Israel is German Staatsräson, reason of state. A very powerful statement, which from the political sort of consequences was rather limited, because it's always been the German principle in foreign policy that Israel is an ally. Israel is perhaps solidarity with Israel is an atonement for the Holocaust, that Germany, West Germany, and since 1990, unified Germany, will stand at the side of Israel. But still, she used this term. And I think this became really problematic in the last couple of years. And my book, History Wars, on German memory politics, it outlined basically that we have a problem with our memory culture because it's too single-minded. And I was arguing that we have a lot of issues which we have to come to terms with, which we don't. All we have is we come to term with Nazism, which is a great achievement. You mentioned Susan Neiman, and I think she's right that it is an achievement that a state, particularly a state like Germany, sort of is very self-critical. And I wanted to open this up and say there are other issues which we ignore, like we are a migrant society. 50% of the German youth in the big cities has a migrant background, meaning their fathers, mothers, or grandfathers are not German citizens, have moved to Germany. So this is sort of the new Germany. It's a complete different Germany to the Germany the Nazis envisioned, which was basically an ethnic, homogeneous Aryan society, white Aryan society. Now, we overcome this, and we have a migrant society, and there is resistance to this. We have a backlash. We have a right-wing party now in parliament, so we have all the debates which basically most European countries and all the U.S. Have. And I wanted to say we have to enlarge. We have to offer to bring these people with their migrant history back into the German consensus of what is German history. And then the terrorist attacks of October 7th on Israel happened. And I think that was the moment when the term Staatsräson got a life of its own. Because suddenly, within a couple of hours, German politicians were saying, oh, this is now a case for this Staatsräson. We now have to be support Israel. And the problem started is that you can't, or I should say, Merkel not only used Staatsräson, but she justified it with the singularity of the Holocaust, with the lessons of history. And the problem is, you cannot argue with the lessons of history. You cannot argue with the Staatsräson. So many German politicians, but also I don't know, city councils, whatever, used Staatsräson now to suppress criticism of the unfolding war between Israel, Gaza. And now that's where the Staatsraison really sort of became quite harmful, because it suppressed open debate. I mean, the debate, not to say, has Israel a right to exist? Of course, I would say it has a right to exist, and you can have this, but you can still criticize the extent to which Germany is supporting the war by Israel. And that has now become limited, suppressed. We had immediately after October 7th a number of cancellations. People who were disinvited from speaking at German universities, at German art forums, etc. And that becomes a problem now for liberal Germany. And that's why the term is so loaded, because it's a term you cannot. There is no democratic discussion about what it could mean, because the term in itself is undemocratic.
I guess what I'm struggling with is my understanding, especially after reading Jenny Vustenberg's book, is that you have this long kind of bottom-up struggle for memory. And memory then becomes, memory of the Holocaust past becomes part of the official establishment. And the people who fought that fight are now part of the establishment. And I also read Jeff Olick's book, Sins of the Fathers. And his point was that it's this long process over time of learning how to speak about the Holocaust. And there are a whole variety of occasions where you've got to give speeches. And it really depends on, is it November 9th and you're making reference to the context of Kristallnacht? Or is it, are you making the speech in the Bundestag? Is it at a former extermination camp? But over time, there are places and of times on the calendar where everybody understands this is the way you need to speak about it. These are the emotions you need to bring. These are the things you can say, you can't say. And there are top-level German politicians who've lost their jobs because they said the wrong thing in the wrong context. And the point that Jenny makes is that these people who become part of the memory establishment, they feel like, well, we know how to do memory. And there's a struggle with people from East Germany who've lived through a particularly difficult history. They want to bring that past into the establishment. And I've heard you made, well, you need, you heard you make this argument that you need to be careful with when memory can get to the point where it becomes ritualized, it can become like a slogan, where there's not a whole lot of thought going on. And Staatsraison seemed to be another version of that, that on the one hand, it seems to be anchored in this past and becomes official policy, but then it stifles critical reflection.
Yeah, I mean, well, again, this is quite complex. Sorry to say that. Because, I mean, you can see, for example, that, yes, I think all you described was true, that, you know, the memory, the critical memory of Nazism had to be enforced by mainly the younger generation against the older generation who was personally implicated in the crimes. So it was never done voluntarily by the German state. So that was a huge fight. The interesting thing is that we have now, if you talk about colonial crimes, and we can get to it in details later if you're interested, we are at a point where the younger generation, those people, as I said, who has a history of migration into this country, who maybe are black, demand that colonial crimes, German colonial crimes, are recognized. Though they are basically were those people after the student revolt of 68 and in the 70s who wanted Nazi crimes recognized by the state were in the 70s. And now they are there. And now those people some of them who were in the 70s on the critical side are now on the state side and are rejecting these claims. So this is the process, I think, where we are. The problem is, again, the question of the universal or the particular licenses. We have speeches in Parliament by the current government about, we remember, on the 27th of January, for example, the day of the liberation of Auschwitz. And they can do this on the 27th of January, and on the 28th or 29th of January, they can advocate a stricter course against migrants, against refugees, against asylum seekers. And they don't see this as being in attention. And it is because, what does it mean? Does it mean we remember the murder of the Jews, or we remember the murder of minorities? Or do we accept that victims of the Holocaust were refugees? Because, I mean, that is one of the points of the strong pro asylum and pro refugee laws which we had in Germany, was because so many people had to flee Nazi Germany. Jews, for example, we want to be a safe haven for political or ethnic refugees, which is good. This is a lesson learned. But now the politicians, as in many European countries, are building this fortress Europe or white supremacy, and I mean, it's not limited to Europe, as you know, and they are doing both at the same time, you know, saying we remember, but and then the next day we sort of advocate the policy against people. The other, which goes against everything, which could be a lesson from Nazi crimes and the Holocaust, and that is the problem. So that for some that in Germany, the remembrance of the Holocaust, a very particular selective memory, has become also an instrument in a political fight against, for example, a multicultural German society. That's what I devote a lot of space in my preface to, is how the Staatsräson, how the solidarity with Israel, and the fight against anti-Semitism in the wake of October 7th could be abused for a policy against Muslim Germans or Muslim migrants, and it was used against them. So the lessons of the Holocaust is used to sort of in a fight against another minority in Germany.
Well, this part is fascinating. So you make the point that you get one lesson from history that's learned that becomes the basis for this state policy to stand by Israel. But then that lesson of history ends up undermining another lesson of history about ethno-nationalism. And Staatsräson becomes this kind of insidious means of drawing a line between who belongs and who doesn't belong to Germany. So how does it help define, especially in the context of the war in Gaza, how does it end up serving the interests of those on the right who have a clear understanding of the insiders and outsiders in Germany?
Okay, maybe I try to stop with lessons learned. Actually, the German citizen law does not allow your German citizenship to be taken away, unless for very, very, very limited occasions. But normally, I learned in school that is a lesson, because Jews were disenfranchised, lost the German citizenship in under Nazism. That's why nobody can be stripped of his German citizenship, which is very powerful. I think it's a very good lesson. So there are some lessons learned. Now, for a couple of decades, Germany struggled with who is German. Is German somebody who is ethnic German, born German? That is the old racist, basically, category, which also the Nazis subscribed to, but which also was used in German colonialism. Or can you, because you have migrated to Germany, become German citizen? So in around the turn of the 21st century, we had a big reform in citizenship law. So they made it easier to apply for German citizenship, and you can get German citizenship even if your father was from Turkey or Portugal or Italy or whatsoever. But a lot of people disliked this, because they believe into basically an ethnic racist concept of German citizenship. Now, say, even for the last couple of years.
It's important to stop here for a second, because I think listeners might not understand that Germany for a long time, for most of the post-war period, had this blood-based understanding of citizenship. So you could be a German from someplace in Russia, living there since the 18th century, come back to Germany and get citizenship because you had a blood connection. But you could be a third generation Turkish person living in Germany and not have access to that. So,
not have access, or very through a very difficult process.
So, and that's a huge change that takes place.
Yeah, that is a huge change, because this citizenship law, the old one, the ethnic one, goes back 100 years to the German Kaiserreich. Basically, or 120 years, and it sort of survived the end of the German Empire, the Kaiser. It survived the end of the Weimar Republic. It survived the end of the Third Reich, and it survived German unification. Hmm. And it was then the first German social democratic green government, Schröder and Fischer, from 1998 onwards. They reformed this, and then it became easier to apply and you could get it. But a lot of people resented this. So they accept, because they have to accept, that there are Germans now who are of Portuguese or Turkish origin, because, I mean, their grandfathers maybe moved into Germany in the 1960s. And then I said, oh, they are German, they are all Germans, but some are real Germans and others are passport Germans, which means Germans who have a German passport but are not ethnic Germans. And you have to know that some people advocated for this. Now, the people said, okay, if you're a passport German, that means you have another passport of another country. So this is your second passport, and you could lose this, which is already breaking this very important lesson of history. You cannot be stripped of German citizenship for anything you do. Now, October 7th, I think on the evening of October 7th, or was it October 8th, some people identifying themselves as Muslim Palestinians celebrated in Berlin, 40 or 50, the Hamas attack. Very, very unfortunate, and I would say I rejected that at the time, that you celebrate a terrorist attack, but they did, 50, 60 people. And that now was used by German tabloids and right-wingers, and this goes very to the middle of German society, and saying, that is not okay. That violates Staatsräson. They should be stripped of their passport. And suddenly you have people saying, oh, yes, normally if you're Germans, it's all fine, but you have to behave. You have to accept German Staatsräson. Again, don't forget, it's from a speech by a German chancellor. It's not it has no legal basis. It's no parliamentary decision of whatsoever. But it says if you violate Staatsräson, you could be stripped of your passport, of your German citizen, and that unfortunately sort of I think the. got wide accepted that you even have now introduced into German citizen law. If you want to become German, you have to sign that you accept the Staatsräson and the right of Israel to exist. If you fail to sign, you can't become German.
Oh, I don't think now, you mentioned this. This gets actually written into the citizenship. This is a more recent development.
Yeah, it's a gray area again. How legal this is? As I said, that courts sometimes much later say no, it's unlawful. But there are cases where people lost their German citizenship or did not get it because of their stand on Israel. Now, it becomes even more loaded if you say that you have in Europe for the last 25 years a rise in Islamophobia. I think if you talk about migrants and should they belong to Europe or not, you don't talk about the British and you don't talk the French and not the Dutch. Yeah? And probably not even the Italians, although in the 60s and 70s, Italians, Portuguese, Spanish, Greek were really frowned upon. But that's not it. What you basically mean is Muslims from Turkey or from Tunisia, Morocco, Syria, etc. And I should also add another important event. In 2015, on the height of the Syrian civil war, Merkel took the decision to allow around 1 million, mainly Syrian refugees, into Germany. And I think that's when this really gave. I think that is one of I told her when I met her that I think she should really, if there's one thing she should be proud of in her chancellorship, it is this decision where really people welcome 1 million refugees. I think that is a lesson of history learned. But in the last 10 years, a lot of political mobilization by the right was against this Muslim immigrants.
Even her party, so, that you mentioned, was not 100%. Her party was divided over that position.
Her party was divided, probably is still divided, but I think that the xenophobes gained momentum. And the thing is, so when we talk about passport Germans who should be stripped of the German passport. We don't talk about the Dutch and not those the Austrians, but we mainly talk about Muslims. And that's why Israel, Gaza, Palestine becomes basically a battlefield for the debate, should Muslims be Germans or not? So it's a lot of these debates are hidden. They are not, you know, it's not up front. Because obviously you said, no, we are not racist, we are not Islamophobe, everybody can become a German. But if you look at where the lines of conflict actually are, then this is basically against Muslims. And you can see that in the weeks following October 7th, even the German president and a major German politicians demanded that Muslims in Germany distance themselves from Hamas terror. And I talked to a lot of them. And I said, why should I? I mean, what? I'm from Tunisia. I'm from, I don't know where. I'm from Bosnia. Why do I have to distance myself from Hamas? This is xenophobic. This is racist. The assumption that because you're Muslim, you are a supporter of terrorism.
And you're talking about the president of Germany, who is including these assumptions in his speeches to the nation. He's singling out a particular population, saying, well, you have the democratic right to protest. There's free speech, but don't take that too far.
I had a very, very moving experience. I think it was December 23. I was giving a talk on memory politics to a group, I don't know, of mainly a Muslim group in Germany who wanted to learn about memory politics, and Steinmeier, our president, had just made this demand for to distance a couple of days ago. So one man approached me, and 5 years ago in Hanau we had a right-wing terrorist, neo-Nazi terrorist attack, who murdered young Muslim man. And though this man approached and said, my son was murdered in Hanau by a German right-wing extremist. And now the president of Germany demands from me that I distance myself from Hamas terrorism. How dare he? I never demanded you Germans, ethnic Germans, distance themselves from terrorism, because I always knew that terrorists are criminals. And you can see how I found it very moving. Because I got to the heart of the matter, and how October 7th is used. I said how the Staatsräson became völkisch. Völkisch is another of these nice German words you can't translate, because it means thinking everything from your folk, from your people, basically from your race. Yeah, and that was the key concept of the Nazis, to say we have a Völkisch Germany, and that excludes Jews, that excludes Sinti and Roma, that excludes Russians and Polish, etc. That is because they're all not Aryan, and suddenly we got a Staatsräson which has become Völkisch because it was used to mobilize against the Muslim minority in Germany.
But if Staatsräson becomes a core feature of German culture, if taking a stand in defense of Israel becomes what it means to be German, to really understand the German past, well, then you can build in these assumptions about, well, certain communities might be more culturally inclined than others to be a part of this. And if this ties into this whole idea of imported or racism or imported anti-Semitism, that you have communities that kind of bring a culture that's just poorly adapted to German values with them, and everyone knows who those communities are.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good example. I mean, the slogan of imported anti-Semitism, of anti-Semitism being brought by Muslim refugees to Germany, it's absurd. I mean, if there's one thing the Germans don't need to learn historically from anybody else, that's anti-Semitism. But suddenly, and that is interesting because it works in a dual way. A, you accuse those coming of being anti-Semitic, which means it's a reason to exclude them because you are a good person. You're not excluding them because you don't like Arabs or Algerians or Turks or because they are Muslims, because everybody is evil. You don't like them because they're anti-Semites. And it culpates your own history, because they are the anti-Semites. Not the that downplays German homegrown anti-Semitism. Okay. And you could also see on October 7th that a lot, there were a moment, and I was very shocked, where a liberal German journalist, very famous one, quoted on Twitter, now X, either on the 7th or the 8th, the death is a master from Gaza. Now, I'm not sure you are familiar with, the Tod ist ein Meister aus Gaza. There is this famous Celan poem, the Tod ist ein Meister aus Deutschland. The death is a master from Germany. And that's probably the most iconic phrase about the Holocaust. That's, death really comes from German culture. Now, on October 7th or 8th, they said, oh, the death is a master from Gaza, which means it's not a master from Germany anymore. So the Hamas Nazis, as some said, replaced the German, the Nazis, the original Nazis. And that is exculpatory, because it allows the descendants of the perpetrators of the Holocaust to switch sides, to move to the other side, and to say, look, the real Nazis now are the Hamas or Islam fundamentalists, and we are on the good side. So we refight the Holocaust, but we are now on the good side. And this all plays into this very twisted public discourse we have in Germany, because yes, we come to terms with the past, but we don't want to really own up to it anymore. So we use it, and we don't want to draw the obvious lessons, which is everybody has human rights. Everybody, or we should accept refugees, political refugees, etc., etc., and we should really get over the idea of an ethnic homogeneous Germany. But in reality, all this are coming back. We want to close the borders. Some of the politicians want to have an ethnic homogeneous Germany, etc., etc.
And this, to me, it goes back to this idea, if memory becomes official and ritualized, maybe there's not a whole lot of questioning of, well, what does that mean in terms of values, of tolerance, of acceptance, of that if you can just pay lip service to atonement, have you really internalized what that means? Does that put you in a position where you can feel like, well, we've dealt with this, we've done this, we understand it, and you can be in this position of what you describe as moral offloading? You can take your burden and just dump it on someone else and say, the problem is not with us. Look, we've dealt with this. It's these other communities that bring these values in that are really at odds with our culture.
I mean, yes, but don't get me wrong. I think a lot of Germans are really struggling with the Holocaust and are really serious and really want to do better. I think they are suffering from this moral responsibility.
I thought you made a point, which was I thought was fascinating, that so you point to a survey, and there's a kind of re-remembering of the past, and among a lot of younger people, there's a desire. You describe it, desire to be good again. And people want to remember that more people really took a stand against the Nazi regime, that more people really opposed to it than was actually the case. And the whole moral offloading is a part of that.
Yeah, there are surveys who says that most young people, they said that they assumed that their own grandparents were in the resistance to the Holocaust. to Nazism. Where all the historical facts we know says, no, the resistance were very, very limited. And in all likelihood, your grandfather or great-grandfather was not a resistance fighter, but a perpetrator. But still, I think one should not belittle their wish to atone and to take moral responsibility, particularly since we have now movements who just get rid of any problematic or any history which they've seen as critical or not heroic enough altogether. So I think one should take them seriously, but also say that politicians or some of them or journalists or so are abusing it also for other means, like fighting for an ethnic homogeneous Germany by saying it's a lesson we learned from our history that you have to fight anti-Semitism. I think I'm all for it. I think one has to fight anti-Semitism, but the biggest problem with anti-Semitism in Germany doesn't seem to be with young Muslim men, but with a German party, which is the strongest opposition party in the German parliament now.
So one of the things I thought was fascinating, this is really ties in more with your introduction, is the rebuilding of the landscape of Berlin, and you talk a lot about this Hohenzollern Palace in the center of Berlin, and how you could really take two different tours of Berlin depending on what part of the city you go in, what you see, you could come away with different impressions. But you make the point that if you look at, on the one hand, the singularity of the Holocaust that becomes part of the German memory culture, it can be used in a particular way to free up other parts of German history that you can then celebrate. And this ties into the ways in which German, the landscape of Berlin is being rebuilt. And it ties into, again, the identity politics of Germany in the present, which you contrast with, you describe as the Berlin Republic, the identity politics of the Berlin Republic versus the Bonn Republic. Although there, I really wonder to what extent, how different is this from the Helmut Kohl period and trying to reclaim a larger German past. To me, it seems like somewhat of a carryover from that time period. But you contrast the two. So could you explain, well, one of the problems, if you really make the Holocaust this singular event, and how does it then pull it out of history in a way that really allows you to not think too much about it? How does it make it into this exceptional event that you really don't have to think about in a critical way, or frees you up from thinking about it in a critical way, and it opens up this broader stretch of history that there's this desire to claim as part of a new German identity in the making? At least, I don't know whether you can say that's just on the right, or is the left a part of that?
I think this goes very in the middle. It's beyond. We always had, I think, conservatives, right groups who were sort of defending German history from this critical engagement. But I think this new narrative, the master narrative, I call it, for the Berlin Republic, I think goes far into the middle. So this right-wing dichotomy doesn't cut it anymore. The example I give is, maybe I explain briefly in case not everybody knows, that in the Berlin was divided after World War II, East Germany, West Germany, and after unification, Berlin became one city, and there was this Palace of the Republic. It was called in the center of Berlin, which was basically the parliamentary building of East Germany. Now, we all know that East Germany was not a parliamentary democracy, so it was mainly the building, and it was right in the middle of Berlin, and it stood exactly on the spot where the Imperial German Palace stood from the German Empire. From 1871 to 1918, Germany had a Kaiser, and his palace was standing there. That palace was destroyed, largely destroyed in World War II through the bombing campaigns, and then demolished under the East German rule. And after unification, the German parliament decided to erase the Palace of the Republic, the East German building, and rebuild the Kaiser's Palace in Berlin. So now, if you go there, you have at least the facade of the Kaiser's Palace. But in the inside, it's completely new. I called it a Prussian Disneyland, because it's not the palace anymore. It's just a facade. But I think the deeper symbolic meaning of it was that the Palace of the Republic and even the wide space surrounding it, or after it was erased, stood for World War II. It stood for the two Germanies. And it stood for the consequences of Nazi policy. And with the rebuilding of the palace, the Kaiser's Palace, I think this history, the remembrance of this German history of violence, of this German century of violence, of racist violence, was literally erased. And I make the example that you now can walk from Unter den Linden to the Berlin Alexanderplatz without seeing that there was Berlin was destroyed in World War II. You could go back to 1914. And I think that's an idealistic sort of version of that German history was okay up to 1914. It was very bad between 1933 and 1945. Most politicians would still agree. Most people would still agree, although we are losing ground on that as well to the far right, but most would agree. But the rest was good. And I take it at this example, though they rebuilt. And it's interesting, thinking of it just now, that Staatsräson is a term from undemocratic Renaissance, and they rebuilt a imperial palace, which is undemocratic, as a symbol of the newly united Germany and the newly united Berlin. And then on top of this palace, they put a cupola and a cross, a Christian cross. And that was disputed, because it said, why do you do that? Why do you do on a secular building a cross? And again, you have this Islamophobic, this anti-Islam, anti-Muslim tendencies in this Berlin Republic. On the conservative right side, and I think that is this new narrative, a new heroic national narrative of Germany, and in order to work this, I think you have to separate the 12 years of Nazi rule from the German history before. And you do that by pointing only to anti-Semitism as a cause of the Holocaust. I mean, in fact, historically accurate, there are many causes. Anti-Semitism, of course, is very important, but there's a general tendency of racism. There is a thinking of social Darwinian thinking of needing living space in Eastern Europe. It is all sort of cut out. It's only anti-Semitism. And that way you disconnect the Holocaust from German history. And I think that the uniqueness of the Holocaust also can be used to stress this point. And that saves German national history in the 19th century.
But I think it's important to add, too, that you're not just rebuilding this palace, that it becomes this museum of ethnographic history. And that works on a couple of different levels, right? There's a forgetting of what history is that connected to, and there's also a desire there to put forward, to put center stage this cultural understanding, an understanding of the cultural achievements of what you really can be proud to celebrate about this larger history.
I mean, that is a deep irony. So they are rebuilding this palace, and they justify it not on imperial and anti-democratic grounds, but saying, but we will build a museum for world culture there. So it's the Humboldt Forum. Again, it's when Germany in the 19th century was really powerful in terms of science and arts and scholarship. It's also going back to this proud narrative of a Germany of science and scholars, and no longer of German soldiers. I think this is also replacing one narrative by the other, now going back to scholarship. And they decided to put in the ethnological collections, the Berlin ethnological collections. And that is a time around 10 years ago, where the debate on stolen colonial art really took momentum. And suddenly, they are faced with it that in this palace, they host stolen colonial objects. And that drew their attention to the question of German colonial crimes, because that is the other big debate in Germany. Do we have to atone for colonial violence? And since 2016, for the last 10 years, people have accepted that Germany actually committed a genocide in German Southwest Africa, in today's Namibia, and that this is the first genocide of the 20th century. And I think that Germany was negotiating with Namibia and is still negotiating since 2016 on how to deal with this fact. But now the question came, is there, and I wrote the book actually, which is called From Windhoek to Auschwitz, what are the links between a genocide in the colonial context in 1904 and a genocide in the context of the racial wars in World War II? And this caused quite a debate in Germany, and that is also an issue here, because it ties down to is there a monocausal explanation for the Holocaust, the anti-Semitism? Then you could combat anti-Semitism, and it's fine, because then you exercised to speak the dangerous tendencies from German history. But if the causes are broader, if it's not only anti-Semitism, it's also social Darwinism, it's racism, it's all those things, then it goes, it's like a cancer, much deeper into German history in the 19th century. And you can't really exercise it. And that is basically at stake. It's a debate about German history in general. Can we be proud of German history? Should we be proud of German history? Or do we have to say if we want to critically engage with Nazism, we really have to be very critical with the
Jürgen Zimmer is a professor of history at the University of Hamburg. I've been talking with him about his recent book, Germany's History Wars: Contesting Memory and Identity Today. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, subscribe on our YouTube channel, send a link to a friend or family member, and review us wherever you can. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.
German Kaiser as well, and the history before the Kaiser. And that's all at stake at this debate in Berlin about the new old palace. As I said, a Prussian Disneyland, because there were only a few stones left, and I think 90% is completely new. But it's still, the facade is it's trying like there is a unviolated German or Berlin cityscape. Okay.
So my sense is that there's a general acceptance and a willingness to see parallels between what happens during World War II and imperial expansion. But if you, so it's one thing to talk about, let's say, living space in the Ukraine and compare that to a desire to carve out living space in Africa during the imperial period. But if you start to question whether it's possible to look at the Holocaust through the lens of the imperial past and to broaden the understanding of what could have brought that about and to go beyond the singularity of anti-Semitism, then you draw a lot of fire because you're really running up against a core feature of the memory culture and German identity all wrapped up in the Staatsraison imperative of the state. And you've drawn a lot of fire for that. Can you explain, well, what, because you're not trying to say that the anti-Semitism wasn't a particular feature of the Holocaust, but you're trying to broaden connections and allow for critical possibilities that go beyond that. Can you explain the kind of the fire that you came under and from where did it come from?
Well, I think that the criticism is, as I said, I mean, it's a debate about German national identity. It's not primarily a debate about the Holocaust. It's not primarily a debate about German guilt. I think in this debate, everybody would agree that Germans are guilty like hell for the Holocaust and for all the crimes, and there is responsibility we as a nation have to carry. That is, I think, quite different to the historians' war in the 1980s, where it's about deflecting guilt. I would say I advocate that Germany, or even more segments of German tradition and history, have to be seen critically. So I want to enlarge responsibility, so to speak. But it is a debate about German national identity and the deep desire by many Germans to have a proper national history to be proud of. I think that's what's at the forefront of this debate about the palace in Berlin. I mean, the thing is, the historical research, if we talk about the Holocaust now, the historical research has shown that, you know, without the war, World War II, without the attack on Poland and then on the Soviet Union, the Holocaust probably would not have happened in the way it had happened. That the war is a condition for the extermination camps. So if we one proves, as I think I do, that the war in the East was a colonial war that separated from the war in the West, World War II in the West, against France, against the British, against the Americans, were fought in a completely different way. It was fought more or less in the tradition of a European war. There were war crimes. I mean, I don't deny it. But if you were a British soldier or an American soldier or a French soldier, and you were caught, your chances of survival, if you were not black, if you were not a black soldier, either from the American or from the French colonial territories or British, your chances to survive were not so bad. In the East, you were a prisoner of war, you were starved to death. 3 million Soviet prisoners of war were starved to death in 1941-42. An immense crime, which I think the German public is not aware of, that it even took place. But so, if you accept that the war in the East was fought like a colonial war against the savages, quote unquote, the Untermensch, that is then the Nazi, the subhumans, the Nazi terminology, then you say then there is also a link to the Holocaust. I mean, I would like to stress that I have a problem with the general term, the singularity of the Holocaust, because I think it's not a scientific assessment, because how do you define singular events? I mean, all historical events are singular. I would say if you want to go about it as a historian, one should say, what about the Holocaust was unique? What about? And then I think there were unique elements, and then I think I can respond to that. And I would say, yes, anti-Semitism was unique, because anti-Semitism as an ideology is different from let's say colonial racism, because it's deeply ingrained that the Jew as such, from the perspective of the anti-Semite, is somewhat superior. That's why he's so dangerous, because there is a world conspiracy. I've never heard of a world conspiracy of Africans or of Sinti or Roma, etc. But for Jews, the anti-Semite is convinced there is this Jewish conspiracy. That's why it's so dangerous. The Jew is so dangerous. That's why you need a final solution. You don't need a final solution in the colonial war. You're normally happy if have ethnic cleansed the territory, or if you killed everybody within your power. But at Rota, that the German general in Namibia, he would not invade the next country to find the last Herero. He wouldn't be bothered. So anti-Semitism has a specific quality, and that's, I think, you can identify the unique. Unique features, but it's not a absolute uniqueness. I mean, that is, it makes sense. I think you can say it politically. You can say it as the victims that the German president says it is as a president. That's all possible, but that are political statements, not scholarly statements.
So, what are, just to conclude with the question of, what are your hopes for the future of remembrance in Germany? What would you like to see? What direction would you like to see Germany go in? And what do you think that's likely to happen?
Okay, when I sort of planned the book, The History Wars, this edited volume, I thought I want to identify all those debates which are disputed, I want to say, which are overlooked, the victims of Nazism, which are overlooked, like gay, queer victims. I want to give space to migrant history. I thought that should be included, and I thought that way we can enlarge, we can open our culture of remembrance so that everybody, every citizen, and I think of citizenship as being inclusive, could participate. Because I thought, in the long run, you cannot establish a memory culture just on the perpetratorhood of your ancestors. because A, now we are fourth, fifth, sixth generation away. And secondly, we have a large population who didn't, their grandfathers didn't live in Germany when that happened. So how do you include this into the lessons that everybody is equal, there are human rights which can who cannot be taken away from anybody, and they said make it more inclusive. Now, after October 7th, I think we have even a more divisive memory culture. And what I try to achieve is to expose the mechanisms, to say, be careful. If you make this or that argument, you might unwillingly support those people who want the ethnic homogeneous Germany back. And I don't want it back.
Jürgen, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Jürgen Zimmer is a professor of history at the University of Hamburg. I've been talking with him about his recent book, Germany's History Wars, Contesting Memory and Identity Today. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, subscribe on our YouTube channel, send a link to a friend or family member, and review us wherever you can. I'm Rick Derderian. See you soon.